Hey, good morning and welcome to another episode of Final Cut Grill, episode 093 on the countdown to 100. Yeah, you heard that right. Hey, so today I have a really fun interview. I'm going to invite you into a sort of a really geeky conversation. You've heard me talk about the big giant screens that I do on occasion, and it's an interesting skill set. It's not rocket science, but it can be a little tricky, and you certainly got to know what you're doing. And I found Stuart Moore. He contacted me through Twitter. Stuart is down in Plymouth, England, which is in the southwest of the country if you're looking on your map and you're trying to find it. And anyway, he contacted me and was like, yeah, let's talk big screen. I'm like, okay, you know, that'll be a show. And the reason it's important for the Final Cut Grill is that last year in December, when 10.1 came out, one of the most important features to me, at least, was the fact that our canvas is now resolution independent. So you can make any size screen that you want. And I believe our friend Alex Golner, that first night that it was released, he made one that was like a million pixels wide or something. He tweeted it last year. Anyway, so that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some of the ins and the outs of doing widescreen video. Now, it doesn't matter what size your screen is, but you're always going to need music. And I'm going to encourage you to go check out our friends at Premium Beat. If you've noticed on their Twitter account, they have a new logo. I think we're going to be seeing more of that around. So there's a slight rebrand going there, but always the same great music. And you know, I love the Premium Beat music. I love the fact that it doesn't get in my way. I've said that a million times, and I still say that, you know, it is one of the hallmarks of good production music is that it doesn't try and be a pop song. It's just problematic. So there's plenty of ways that you can purchase their music. You can get a full song. You can get the loop packs. You can get the shorts. And it's important to remember that sometimes the loop packs don't include something that feels like a beginning and an end because they are loops. So sometimes you'll have to buy, you know, the original song as well, and you'll still do a little bit of editing, but it's a lot of fun. So anyway, go check out Premium Beat. Do that for me just as a favor. I'm going to ask, you know, they've been very generous to support what we're doing here, and go check it out. I promise you, you're going to find something that you like. So anyway, enough of the commercial biz. We are going to go all the way over to Plymouth, and, you know, Stuart had been out shooting all day, and I hooked up with him at the end of his day, and it was the middle of the day here. So let's go to Stuart Moore, widescreen expert in Plymouth, England. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So Stuart, you've been following me on Twitter. I've been following you, and I made some comments about big screens. And you said, "Oh, I do some of those." So that's what I want to talk about. That and Final Cut 10's resolution independence, which turns out to be a great feature for guys like you and I.
Yeah.
So tell me, how did you get started in this business?
Well, it was quite a convoluted kind of path. Which was when I was back at college, I did biology, and as part of that we did a bit of photography, which then led into community video, which then led into TV, and and then so it was kind of a no great plan, just ended up where I am now, wherever that is.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, you say that, because I was reading a book once about now I'm drawing a blank, but it was, I believe it was the Journeys of Captain Cook, maybe.
Oh yes.
and he and maybe it's not Captain Cook, but anyway, there was I want to say like 1800s, possibly, traveling around the world, and, you know, without photography, if you were a botanist, you had to sit down and draw.
Yeah.
All of the plants and animals and whatnot that you were discovering. And it was like a whole part of your of your skill set. Like, yes, I study plants, and look, this is what I drew, and you know, yeah, you have all these old sketchbooks. So it's interesting, you know, you bypass that part, and but photography gets used in a lot of fields, you know, at the kind of documentation level.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's what it was all about. Just taking, I was doing plant physiology, and then taking pictures of plants, and you know, just got more interested in the photography than the biology. But
Stuart takes wonderful pictures, but he doesn't apply himself to his schoolwork.
Yeah. So yeah, and then just kind of moved into video, and then and ended up in TV, but doing no editing. But then I think in '97, kind of got a reasonable Mac, and and then started in Premiere, the old Premiere,
the pre Premiere Pro,
pre Pro. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I think I did a little bit of Premiere 4.2,
I think, 4.2. If I remember, was a
that was kind of a sweet spot. That was right before Randy Eubulos left Adobe to go to Macromedia and eventually to Apple. That was where he said, "Yeah, I need to recode this from the ground up," and Adobe would not let him do that.
Yeah.
And
so that took a while to get there, then, didn't it? Because many years later.
Yeah. I love that history story. I've told it a million times.
Anyway, yeah.
So you've been doing this quite some time, but it's really, yeah, you really just got into editorial in around 97-ish, right?
That's right. Just because it was, you know, at the time when, because where I am in the Southwest England, the only real, there's a few Media 100s that you remember well, don't you?
Right. But
it's really, as you know, I mean, I'm sure it's the same in the States, that really professional TV editing was all Avid, and it was, you know, tens of thousands of pounds over here to be set up to do anything like that. So it was only really with Premiere and with Max getting more, you know, kind of affordable, that, you know, it's quite amazing to be able to edit stuff, you know, in your own kind of home or business setting, and you know, not very stable. And I remember, you know, rendering in Premiere, and it was a, you know, making shorts, and it was a, you know, the, well, I suppose it was back in the classic Mac days, wasn't it, with the extensions loading, and you had to turn some off in order to edit, and different world now.
It really is interesting. Although I gotta say, I will say, you know, I've been putting Yosemite on some of the machines around the office. Actually, I'm supposed to finish that off this afternoon. It really alarmed me to see that there is now an extensions control panel. I'm like, oh no, please. Yes. I don't want to do that anymore. I think it has to do with browsing. I haven't really read up on it, but it definitely scared me when I saw that word pop up.
Yes, I've turned the contrast up or whatever it is, and to cut down the transparency, and it does look a little bit like OS 7. It's a little before my time, but you know, it looks like kind of classic Mac, which is kind of sort of interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. So, so you never did any tape editing? It was always computer, correct?
No, did, but not you know, kind of. Not professionally, but you know, not for kind of broadcast stuff. So it was kind of shooting on tape and stuff like that, and handing it all over. So but did do some kind of low band, you know, 2-machine, 3-machine editing, and it was really that then, you know, that was really expensive, in the, you know, to have, you know, you'd have to have a kind of a bit of a business plan to really, you know, be buying your own.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so I could kind of you know, remember that well, and but you know, it's quite interesting that with really, as the Macs got cheaper, it was you know, possible to kind of do your own editing, which was really you know, really fantastic. And,
yeah, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the business plan, because I know that when I ran my own business, my philosophy always was that, and this is clearly a business plan, it's not a very good one. My philosophy was always that I never wanted to get so deep into something that I couldn't legitimately call it a really expensive hobby.
Yeah, so, no, I mean, the same with me, yeah.
So like, if one day I decided, yeah, you know, I'm going to go get a real job, which is a bad option to leave on the table if you're trying to be successful in this business. But if I was ever going to get a real job, I probably would still own all of this stuff anyway because I really love this stuff. Now, as it's turned out, it's worked out okay. So how did you get into doing the sort of, we'll call them off resolution or widescreen videos, and how did that come about?
Well, that was where I'm based in Plymouth, although at the time I was working at another university, because as well as kind of doing TV work and kind of running a production company of sorts, I have kind of been working and lecturing in various kind of art colleges and universities over the years. And the one, although I wasn't actually working at Plymouth University, which is kind of a large one in Plymouth, UK, there was a kind of initiatives or a kind of a, I don't quite know what you call it, it's called ICCI, a kind of a department that was innovation in the creative and cultural industries. And the person who was running that, I'm not quite sure how they got into it, but they got into 360 degree video, which was quite innovative. That and we're working with a company called Igloo Vision in the UK, which, like the name suggests, they'd have these kind of igloo-shaped domes from 9 meters across and getting, over the years, getting much larger with projection inside. So you'd kind of go in through the tunnel into this dome, and then you'd be surrounded by 360 video. And although, you know, I don't work for the Igloo company, but my understanding was that it started in kind of festivals like Glastonbury in the UK, and it was basically like a rave tent. So you'd go in and there'd be music playing and there'd be video projected all around, you know, so you're in this kind of immersed in, you know, what was often like computer generated kind of rave graphics and stuff, but, you know, quite a full on visual experience.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's one thing to have 360 degrees of visual excitement, but I think that it becomes infinitely more difficult when you say, I'm going to put an image that is 360 degrees, where it's actually, so actually, let me ask you about that. Do you ever do that where you're shooting either with like panoramic video or multiple cameras where you're stitching it together so it is an immersive experience?
Yeah, it's all kind of variations on that, really. So the kind of system which this Igloo Vision developed, there's five projectors. So essentially, you've got five HD 16:9 images which go around the whole 360, and so, you know, as their kind of business developed, they had this collaboration with ICCI in the university in Plymouth, and so the university side was kind of commissioning and creating content to develop what was quite an innovative I don't know what you call it, a format experience,
right.
And so, yeah, so that kind of varies from early on. I don't know if you've heard of them, but Point Grey Ladybug cameras, which were kind of 360 degree cameras that it's a Canadian company, and so they had this Ladybug 2, I believe, and that would film 360, but it was quite complicated. There was a digital, like an optical digital feed from the camera to another box. And then there was a firewire from the box to a laptop, which tended to be a PC laptop. So there was quite a tricky chain of events to come from the picture to a recording. And
So I know you do some shooting. Do you ever shoot content for it as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And as it developed, where they've gone, like a lot of people, they had these, you know, the kind of the mirror, the catadioptric, you know, kind of mirror reflector to make an HD picture into the kind of the 360 donut shape.
Right.
But now very much like a lot of other people, a lot of it is with kind of little computer print, you know, the kind of 3D printed kind of holders for however many GoPros. So now it seems to be going a lot of GoPros.
They're actually building the mount by printing crap out of 360 stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, just because it's because the angle of view of the GoPros, and you know where you want them to point. So they just do a CAD drawing and then print the holders and slot in five or six GoPros, and so it's a whole kind of range, and other stuff is kind of generated, you know, kind of in After Effects or some animation, you know, right. into actually because they tend to be a 720 height image, so it's like 6400 pixels by 720,
right?
You know, as a single panoramic image, whether it's a composite or kind of filmed by whatever camera is needed, or, you know, filmed with several cameras and then kind of, you know, basically composited together. So,
right.
You know, all kind of variations on that, on how to, project into these domes.
Yeah, it's a very interesting problem. And really what you find as you start dealing with ultra wide screens is it's the vertical resolution that determines everything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've done 7,000 and change at 720. And we actually recently, we actually kind of lost the job. I don't know why, but it was going to be 10,000 plus at 1080. So roughly the same aspect ratio, almost 10 to 1. And I actually had occasion about, 6 or 8 months ago, where one of our clients was talking. They were in meetings with a rental house, and the rental house was kind of urging them on to up their budgets to be able to cover the cost of doing 4K projection.
Yeah,
and I was like, "Oh, please no! Wait a second. Do you have any idea what you're getting yourself into?" Because I know that this company has a predilection for these giant wide screens, and I had to make this very intricate little slideshow. Maybe I'll make a demo and put it online. I don't know if I can do that with some of the content that's in. Anyway, yeah. But I made this thing. I go, "Look, here's a standard F frame of video. Here's an HD frame of video. Here is, you know, this, and here is this, and now here's 4K. Now, if you're going to do the same, and then I took an example of one of the current projects that we were just finishing up, and I said, if we had done this video at 4K resolution, we'd be talking about, and I think it was something like 12,000 pixels or something. And I said, that's fine, except we can't shoot video like that. So you have to realize, do you really want to go this way? I mean, you could shoot 6K red, but you're still going to have to double it. And that's not really healthy for the pixels involved.
I mean, with these domes, because they're coming with however you're recording it, and I believe, you know, people have been recording 6K on reds, but one of those, you know, facing upwards with the mirror lenses that forms the 360, and it's still even then, because you've got the kind of the donut shape of the image, you know, across the vertical height of the sensor, it's still not hugely high res, you know, just because you've got to fit two kind of the top and the bottom of the can you picture it, the kind of a donut shape onto the sensor, which then gets warped back out into a panorama. So so I believe the Igloo Vision, they very well paying clients, they've gone quite high res now, but you know, their basic setup was, you know, either small HD at 6400 by 720 or 9600 by 1080 as you know, basically. And I think it's just the cost of the projectors into these domes, and Yeah, because you need five of everything. And
yeah, the projection cost, and you know, for the shows that I do, they're doubling up everything for backup. Yeah. So, and I think the largest I've done was 6 projectors. So you're talking about 12 very costly, very high-end projectors, and all of the, you know, because I'm doing short installs. I guess the Igloo one is be a short install, not a permanent install.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's 2 or 3 days of hanging projectors and aligning them, and I'm so glad I'm not involved in that part.
No. I mean the Igloo ones. It's if you can imagine this. You know, almost like a semicircular dome, and you're inside it, and the 5 projectors are in the ceiling,
right?
And so they're projecting, you know, onto a dome which is going away from them, and so it's kind of like mad curving keystoning, and they've got these, you know, it's very fascinating to watch, you know, kind of grids that they project, and then they have to line them all up, and the domes, some parts of the domes are inflated, so you know, it's a constant, because the 5 projectors have to be edge blended, so you have to have like 10% either side, and then they kind of knit them together, you know, to get a kind of a seamless
right.
image, if that's what you as the filmmaker, you know, is intending, you know, rather than individual, you know, images around the dome.
Okay, so if you didn't think the last 18 minutes was nerdy conversation, we're going to get super nerdy here, Stuart and I, because I want to ask you about some of the methodology that you use. It's awesome now that Final Cut 10 is resolution independent, and
yes.
We will talk about that. That happened with 10.1, but just so we can appreciate what we have now, let's talk about how we were doing it beforehand. So how did you compose a video that was, let's say, I don't know, you pick a number, something by 720, like...
Yeah, say so just basically the 6400. So if people at home are doing the maths, then it's, you know, it's 1280 times 5 is all the way around the 360. So there's basically worked a couple of ways with it. And one was in After Effects, where just working with... the full 6400 times 720, and then in that way to kind of split out the amounts for the 5 projectors, then you'd basically, you know, have a wind, you know, if you imagine you've got the full panoramic image, mm-hmm. and then you in After Effects, the kind of methodology is having the 5 screens, you know, almost as the windows, adjacent windows with the 10% overlap looking onto that panoramic image, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I've done it a bunch.
Yeah, and that's quite, you know, conceptually quite easy. But the other way was working from Final Cut 7, and then it was, you know, because it didn't have the resolution to actually have a 6400 wide kind of canvas, then with that way it was kind of then thinking of 5 screens.
Oh,
plus
good
the
grief, you've actually been able to pull that off.
Yeah, and it's only, you know, once your mind's set in it, it's really just thinking you've got the 5 5 screens that are 1536 by 720, which is the, you know, the 128 pixels either side,
right.
And then yeah, so it's another way of looking at it. But the kind of catches that then, and there's a lot of catches with these panoramic rather than, I think you were doing very wide kind of screens.
Yeah,
but the panoramic, it's you know, if you think it's almost like a problem if you're thinking of it in terms of projecting 5 images side by side, you know, whereas in some ways it's better to think of it as one image wrapping around. But how
right.
you dealt with it is you know, there were these two ways really, or sometimes I do a bit of both. So you'd have like 5 layers in Final Cut 7, you know, and then be offsetting them. And then playing them back on on an external monitor with a very thin strip to see how your editing was working. You know that it was all and one, this might make you laugh, that the for reasons best known to themselves, Igloo Vision system, screen one was on the right and it went from right to left. So it was so left to right in Final Cut or After Effects would be 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Just because they couldn't be. Things can be too complicated, so it's also exactly the projector one, then you turn to the left, projector two, left, so it's kind of going.
How did they start doing that?
No idea. It was just that's just how it was. But that was just another bit of mental gymnastics. And also, whether it came from Final Cut or from After Effects, you'd end up with the 5 video images to play through each projector. And so the system was that you'd have 5, so you'd have 5 folders, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and in each folder would be the appropriate video for that projector. But each video image, each video clip would have exactly the same name as the one in 2, 3, 4, 5. So you'd have, say B105. Was where it would play in the program, and that you'd have 5 files, going from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in separate folders, but to look at, as in the Finder, looked exactly, not looked visually, but in name convention. So, if you can imagine, under pressure, you'd have to copy your files, the appropriate, identically named file into 5 folders.
Why not just append each file name with, screen A, B, C, D, E, or whatever?
It was with, and I can't speak for the company, and it's probably all changed now, but I believe it was then that the computers or the Macs playing out would then, would be playing, in the playlist. It would be looking in a folder, because often it would be a playlist for whole kind of program or day's mm-hmm. events. It'd be looking, now we're going to play, film B105, so it would look in the 5 folders for B105 and play them on the appropriate. So it kind of makes sense, but in terms of file management, particularly if like me you're not particularly organized, it's there's many an opportunity to end up with a bogus clip playing on one of the 5 screens.
So. Very, very much so. God, I'd really want to challenge that. Say, really? This is a recipe for disaster if something gets jumbled.
Yeah, and I think it was because, this is going back a few years now, and I think it's, decisions were being made and it was all kind of bespoke. And, with hindsight, I guess we could all be a lot more organized maybe, but... I don't really know how it happened, but this going right to left and the naming conventions was tricky. And of course, as you're getting into gigabytes of file sizes, that before Thunderbolt, this was where if you had to make changes, the time to reload everything onto the computer at the big onto the playout system at the beginning of a show, it's quite stressful. You make a change and then you want to copy it onto a hard drive and it's USB 2 or FireWire and plenty of stress involved.
I don't think you fully understand exactly how much data you have just asked me to change.
Yeah.
I had that happen once where I was flying into Chicago to oversee the installation on one of the widescreens I had done. And as I'm landing in Chicago, I turn on my phone and it lights up like a Christmas tree. And there's a dozen text messages from the producer and the production manager and like, uh-oh, this can't be good. And they had decided for whatever reason that we needed to downscale my resolution from 1080 projection scale to 720 projection scale.
Yeah.
And this was before Final Cut 10. And I said, I appreciate that you would like to make that change, but I want you to know that there are probably not enough hours between now and tomorrow morning to actually make that happen.
Yeah.
You go, well, I don't understand. And I said, I understand that you don't understand, but you need to understand. I'm not.
You can't just wish it into being.
I'm not making this up. You're talking about re-rendering something that took many, many hours. Because at that time, I was doing everything, and I still use After Effects. I made a comment about After Effects on Twitter a few days ago or last week, whatever. And I can't remember who it was, but somebody came in with, oh, yeah, what a piece of junk that is. I responded back real quickly. I do not think After Effects is a piece of junk. It's a very powerful tool. It's got 20 years of legacy plus, and I probably use After Effects every single day. But in this particular instance, my workflow has always been to make a single canvas that is the target scale. And then what I do is I make five or six, whatever, subcomps.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Like I was describing as windows into your
correct.
Bigger
so,
comp.
And
yeah,
and I name those, you're doing 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. In the States, we actually get to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but then again, we drive on the right-hand side of the road too.
That could be something. Yeah.
And so then what I'll do is very meticulously, I will bring the master comp into each one of those subcomps and meticulously align and so you were saying a 10% overlap. I have never found that the overlap is consistent, but always the people that do this kind of projection, they use a piece of software. I believe it's called Blenders with a Z. And have you ever seen these documents? I'll see if I can post one. It's actually quite fascinating because it'll give you the full pixel count. It'll give you the pixel overlap. It'll give you the projection cone width, the projection distance, the projection millimeters of the lens. It's really fascinating. And it's basically a complicated spreadsheet, but it prints out from some software that these projection guys use. At any rate, and it will define the overlap. And then also what's really nice is the Blender software will also generate a test JPEG. And the JPEG has targets and the overlap is defined and its actual size. So what I typically do is I'll take that target JPEG, drop it into the master comp, and then as it flows into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, you can actually see how it's overlapping. And you go, okay, click, and you can finesse it, zoom in and make sure that the pixels are exactly right. But once you do that, right, once you create that, and in the past I think I've talked about it, I call that my rig, you never have to think about it again. And so because you're not setting, and I know that you can do this like in After Effects, you can set like a bounding region, like only export these pixels from here to here. But there's so much opportunity, I think, to screw that up. I build this rig once, and then every time I kick out my five files, because, like we found out in Chicago, landing at O'Hare, there could be a change. Once you have that, your iterations will be exactly the same from version 1 to version 20 or whatever.
Yeah.
And you don't have to think about, oh, I was tired, it was the middle of the night, I did my bounding box wrong, and now all of a sudden everything doesn't align. So it's nice to get that out of the way.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we get to Final Cut 10. So when 10.1 comes out,
yes.
How quickly did you start toying with the resolution?
Well, it was just really one thing came up, which was a project from 2012, which was the Olympics, and there was a very big dome set up in Weymouth, which is on the south coast of England, mm-hmm. Where they were having sailing, the Olympic sailing events. And so there is a kind of a parallel kind of event with the actual sports of which in Weymouth was water sports, called the Cultural Olympiad. And so there was some money available, and so a very large, I think it was 21 meter diameter dome was set up for several weeks, and with a colleague, I actually got to program and create, curate and make work, and just actually do the technical stuff of putting it all together for a kind of a long weekend program. And one of those projects was an actual kind of a kind of a fairly straight panoramic project from taken in the city of London, where there's a monument to the Great Fire of London in 1666 that was built afterwards as a memorial. And a filmmaker called Chris May Andrews had done quite a high-res time lapse using, you know, 1D or, you know, some kind of pretty decent Canon that was just a photographic time lapse. And so I kind of adapted that to this dome. And then this ICCI organization were taking their own kind of projection rig to Germany a few months ago. And that and they wanted to kind of represent this monument film. And so, you know, I was thinking, had been a gap between doing any of this work. And I was thinking, oh, back to After Effects, you know, remember what the dimensions were, where the subcomps had to go, and all of this. And then I thought, well, you know, Final Cut 10, now you can just, you know, it's resolution independent. I'll just give it a go and just kind of pop the clip, which was, you know, kind of created in QuickTime from the JPEGs that I believe they were, the kind of high-res stills, and put this QuickTime in. It fitted fine, and played back in real time, and it was just you know, none of the rendering in After Effects. It was just so easy. It was almost like you know, laughable that, yeah, it just worked so well. That I just thought, oh, well, that was quite easy. And
it's like, I know, I totally agree. I know what you're saying, because I remember the first time I started dropping stuff into a big timeline. I think it was the 7,000 pixel thing, and it's 7,300 or something, whatever. And I started by putting a solid background in the frame. I'm like, well, okay, obviously that's going to play. Then I dropped a 1920 by 1080, you know, center cut thing, or actually, yeah, I think it was 1920, 1080. So actually it had to be scaled down to get it vertically. And I hit play and I was like, okay, that works. Then I duplicated it a few times and stacked it up on top of each other in the timeline, but spread it out from each other in the canvas. So you have the left window, the center left, center right, and far right window. Hit play.
Yeah.
Didn't even pause. It's like, yeah, okay, what else? It's like, really? Like, yeah. Didn't hesitate at all. And you just sit there and you start giggling. It's like, what has happened to the world?
Yeah, it's the same experience. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it's just, yeah, and this was, you know, this was on 27-inch iMac, yeah, not the very top spec, only an i5, you know, quad core, and it just played so smoothly, and it's a fair size. I think it was about 16 minutes long, you know, at this 6400 by 720, and because the shape of this project was, it was kind of too tall for the dome, and then this ICCI now have a kind of a projection room device, which is a cylinder. So rather than being a dome, it's a cylinder, which they call the rotunda, and that had a slightly different size. So what had happened with this time lapse, which is the view from the top of this monument in the city of London, so you could see all the kind of landmarks, the River Thames, a full 360. But because it was shot on a stills camera, it was, you know, it was taller, and the clip that had been made from it was taller than it needed to be to fit into this rotunda. And so what we've done in the dome, in After Effects, we kind of keyframe move. So as the, because in the daytime, the view of the city looked great, but there's also fantastic clouds and all the kind of jet trails, you know, just look fantastic. So as the day came, the whole comp kind of panned up, or the picture dropped down, so you're seeing more of the sky. And then at night, when the sky was blank, you'd look down and see all the traffic and the lights of London. And so this was done by kind of keyframing up and down and rendering. And then in Final Cut 10, you just kind of put these keyframes in. And it just did it in real time. I was like, well, you know, it's just too easy. So it was a real revelation. So and as I say, not on a high-end iMac either. So
I'm surprised you said it was an i5. I always pay extra for the i7s.
Yeah, I had because I did have a Mac Pro, and it was getting too tired. So I got rid of that, and then I've just got this i5 iMac as a stopgap, because the new, you know, in typical annoying Apple fashion, you knew a bigger, better, faster iMac was on the horizon. So I didn't want to buy, you know, I'm not sure, what is it, 2012 or 2013, whatever, right, the one before the latest refresh.
Right.
And then, you know, Phil, then you had to keep it. So I just bought a refurb one from the Apple store with the
i5. That's a good idea.
Yeah. And then, of course, now it's kind of working all right. So I'm thinking, shall I now wait for the next refresh? But the 5K one is quite tempting.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw it, but the other day I was at the Apple store to deal with some issues with our purchase. And I had to I was playing around with one of the 5Ks, and I opened up, you know, Final Cut, and I opened up some content that was 1920 1080, and I put a 1920 by 1080 canvas in the viewer, and then I took a snapshot of the whole screen.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, and a little postage stamp.
It's like, oh, how cute. That's HD. And even, you know, my boss has been, you know, we've been doing enough of these giant screens that he is now caught himself on multiple occasions, and I'll point it out, and I'll go, oh yeah, I did it again. He's been referring to HD video as standard def. Well, we could get some standard stuff. And then it dawned on me, it's like, oh wow, what would a 720 by 486 video window look like on that 4K? And somebody else mentioned that I should have done is, you know, hit Command Shift F and played back that 1920 full screen and see, you know, does it look horrible? It's going to have to scale it up quite a bit. It'd be interesting. I don't think Apple would allow it to look horrible, so they might be doing some other things. You know, sometimes I think, and I could be wrong with this, but I think in QuickTime 7 at least, when you hit Command F and went full screen, if your video was a lot smaller than the desktop.
Oh yeah, it used to
it would change the video resolution to more closely match the size of the video and then play it full screen.
Mm.
And I wonder if maybe the 5K does anything like that. And yeah. I could be wrong about that. Maybe it's just me wishful thinking, which I do a lot of when it comes to stuff like that.
I mean, for me, it was, I thought it was a bit of a, although the place I worked till last summer, another university where I'd basically chosen what Macs to buy and stuff like that, so I was aware of these kind of iMacs. I was a bit nervous of actually having an iMac rather than a Mac Pro, and it's actually, even this, I wouldn't recommend getting an i5, because, you know, you really notice, even like in compressor, I've got a quad core i7 MacBook Pro, and those extra virtual cores or however they describe them are definitely worth it. But yeah, they're surprisingly good, the iMacs, which is probably not news to most people, but I'd always kind of gone for the Mac Pros and just kind of held off on the new Mac Pros just because everything else was so expensive to go with it, all the Thunderbolt connected stuff. So
yeah, and clearly there is some growing pains here. I immediately started speculating. I don't know if most people know this, but with an iMac, there's a functionality called Target Screen Mode, not Target Disk Mode. Now,
it as a monitor. Yeah,
right. So if you don't know this, if you shut down a Macintosh and started up holding down the letter T, it goes into what's called target disk mode.
And yeah, target disk mode, FireWire as it used to be, wasn't it?
Right. It does it with FireWire. It also does it with Thunderbolt. and or I like to say a Thunder Tube. But basically what it does is it turns that Mac on and treats that output port as though the whole Macintosh is now just a hard drive. Okay, so like let's say you walk into an edit suite with your laptop and you have some really big files. Sometimes the easiest way to get that off is to go into target disk mode, attach a Thunderbolt cable, and just loop it onto your system, because now you're getting, you know, 10, I always forget the words, you know, 10 gigabit, whatever. Anyway, you're getting, yeah, 10 good things as opposed to, you know, gigabit being, so gigabit and then 10 gigabit. So gigabit is what your Ethernet is going to be. 10 gigabit is what your Thunderbolt port is going to be. So it's a quick way to do it. Now, I can't remember the, you know what, let's do a little bit of research here. So Mac target screen mode. I'm going to give you the keyboard shortcut for that. What is TDM, they call it? Target display mode. Here we go. How do I do... there's a breakdown. What is the keyboard shortcut, dude? Command. Okay. Some older keyboards. Okay. To leave target display mode, press Command F2 on the keyboard. Connect a mail domain mini display board or Thunderbolt cable. Press Command F2 on the keyboard and the iMac being used as a display to enable TDM. And you have to, on some machines, you have to use the function key, whatever. Okay, that gets more complicated. That was really bad radio. Sorry. I know right now this one of those times where I say, yeah, I should edit that out, and I know I won't, so I'll just leave it. But anyway, target display mode allows you to use a Macintosh as a display. So immediately I thought, oh, new 5K iMac. Boom, I have target display mode, and I now have a 5K monitor. Not so. So apparently what goes down is that the limiting factor is not the number of pixels you actually have on the display, but it's the Thunderbolt display port, whatever, language being spoken. So the Thunderbolt tube is actually maxing out to do a 4K display. And what that means is, the Mac, even the Mac Pro, cannot display on the 5K iMac, okay? So what will more than likely happen, we can only speculate because nobody knows. And if somebody does know, they work for Apple and they won't talk because they like their job. And if you're like me and you don't work for Apple, you can speculate all you want. What we'll probably end up seeing is a bump in the Thunderbolt protocol in the next rev of Mac Pros to be able to support a 5K display. And then it appears as though Apple is just going to skip over the 4K display world and just bring us 5K displays in the near future, maybe. Who knows? But that was a bummer when I saw that. It's like, oh really? Okay.
Yep.
And then the other thing is I think I tweeted a snapshot of the here's a good trick. If you have a Retina Mac of any flavor, and you want to know what the pixel density is of your display at any given moment, do a screen capture of your whole display. Command-Shift-3, and it's going to take a snapshot of your screen. And I did that on the 5K iMac, and then you open that up in preview and turn on the Get Info, and it tells you that display was 6,400 pixels across.
Wow.
And I don't know how that jives with 5K, but that's actually the number of pixels that you're looking at. I'll read it to you. It was 6,400 by 3,600 pixels at 144 pixels per inch. Anyway, a lot of pixels, very close to doing my current video that I'm working on, which is 69 or 5,900. No, I think it's 6,900 pixels wide. Anyway, so now, have you done – here's the question I really wanted to get to with you, Stuart. I am currently in the middle of doing a widescreen I just mentioned, the one I can't remember how big it is. I have yet to do my cutting, my slicing, whatever you want to call it, in Final Cut. I have not done it yet.
Yeah.
I have the 7,000 pixel display I did recently earlier this year. I actually kicked out a ProRes Gigantor file and dropped it into a rig.
Back into your system, yeah.
Into an After Effects rig that I've done in the past. And it wasn't until as I was handing the USB stick to the projectionist going, yeah, here's your six files, it dawned on me, you know, I probably could have cut those in Final Cut. I just hadn't done it yet. So I was wondering, have you done that in Final Cut yet?
Yeah, I have done, yeah. And it was really, really easy as well. So it was just you know, making the edit file that was 6400 by 720, the kind of a finished complete film. And then making that into a compound clip, and then just setting up another timeline with the size of window that you need for each projector, and then I can't remember the maths, but the offsetting, you know, so the individual one would come in the right place, right. You know, was really, really simple as well. So there was kind of that worked really well. But the one that went to Germany, because that was on. Do you know the Watch Out system, which I think you mentioned?
Yeah, Watch Out is a PC-based magic box of science where what ends up happening, and because I've watched the projectionist do this on a six screen, he brings in the six files. He actually requested the audio as a separate file, which scared the bejesus out of me. I'm like, okay, and he ends up building a timeline essentially.
Yeah.
And somehow that thing breaks it out to all of the cables that need to go.
Yeah, so it's quite clever, although it's quite hard to get a grasp on it. But essentially, it didn't need the Watch Out system could have handled. It could play out the one file at 6400. Wide, or in fact this one in the rotunda which you're talking about, this one is a different aspect ratio, so that's 5600 by 720, but it would have done it for 6400. It'll just play that straight. The only problem being the PC kind of friendly codec. So the it likes H.264, but you can't compress. You know, there's a maximum width in H.264 that'll compress properly.
Right.
And so, so for this one, it was just a question of splitting the two in half. No edge blending, nothing else. Just giving the left file and the right file at the half the pixels, and then that was just pieced together. It looked really simple in the Watch Out. It's almost you just placed them side by side, lined them up, and then the actual software and the hardware of the Watch Out system then just sends the appropriate stuff off to each projector. So it was very, very, very simple.
It's really fascinating. So do you typically deliver H.264?
It kind of for the Igloo systems, it was generally ProRes LT, just as a kind of fairly universal but reasonable file size. So that was ProRes LT, but then it was just finding what this Watch Out system, what codec it would kind of use. So and I believe you can I'm not a PC person, but I believe you can license ProRes for PC systems.
Yeah,
so,
as it turns out, it's actually very, very, very difficult to do. When I was at NAB this last year, I went the first night I was there, I was with Alex McLean, my partner on Digital Cinema Cafe, and he got invited to I'm sorry, Alex, I'm probably gonna get this wrong, but I believe it is Scratch, which is one of the high-end coloring tools that's
Assimilate Scratch.
That's what it was. It was Assimilate. So we got invited to the Assimilate barbecue, which is a great event if you ever get a chance to go to it. And it's not like it's a crazy, you know, Vegas party, but they had great food. They really know what they're doing. And it was at a pool at some off the strip crappy little hotel, but you could, anyway, long story. So great food. And we were talking with the people at Assimilate because they had, I believe, just at this NAB, this 2014, were announcing that they now had full ProRes support. And we were chatting with one of the guys, and you know, basically he said, yeah, it was a long, drawn out, protracted agreement phase with Apple to be able to do that because, you know, and I'm speculating again, I don't know anything. You know, I think Apple really protects the ProRes intellectual property, and they're very careful of that. So it can be done. I don't know. I don't think it's readily available, and I think if you're a PC company that wants to support ProRes, you have to, you know, probably, you know, gird your loins for a long battle with Apple to try and, you know, encourage them to license it to you. But and I don't know if any of that was proprietary information, but obviously,
no. I mean, it's pain, isn't it? Because if it was more universal, you know, or an actual standard, it would help everyone. I think really that.
I love it.
I mean, we're not going to switch standard to PC. Well, I suppose some people do anyway, but yeah. But really, just your kind of question about how easy it was to kind of go from the panoramic or the very wide image. You know, in this case, if it was 6400 wide, I made a compound clip and then just set up a new project at 3200 wide and then put it in once to the left, once to the right. You know, put it far to the left, export one H.264, put it to the right, export the next H.264. So, it's been a kind of a bit of a revelation because it's just been so easy. I'm sure there must be catches. And as you say, that you know, obviously you can composite stuff, do far more sophisticated stuff in After Effects, but just the ease of use has been a real revelation.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'll mention is that this current video that I'm working on, I actually was making full size, full frame, ProRes 4x4 files, you know, with an alpha channel.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And I was making little graphical elements to drop over my video elements that were filling the frame. So those were playing in real time also. So imagine a giant canvas of whatever pixel wide, we'll call it 6,000 for now. It's 6,000 by 1080, and I don't think that's the right dimension, whatever. And now you have another video that's 6,000 by 1080, and it has an alpha channel, which essentially is like a third video, technically, if you think about it. And all of that was playing in real time.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? It's, you know, it sounds, you know, with you are the Final Cut grill man, but you know, I don't think it's perfect, and you know, there's things we'd all like to change. But some of the stuff under the hood is, you know, it's quite remarkable. And that's really, I'm not an After Effects expert, but I've used it for years. And some of the rendering, especially with Premiere Pro, you know, kind of using the graphics card and all of that, you know, you kind of wonder what they're doing with After Effects, where, you know, I'm guessing what every After Effects artist would want would be, you know, kind of real time.
Real time After Effects, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting thing. And I actually had a discussion with this with a friend of mine the other day, and I said, you know, the key thing, and we'll leave it at this, but the key thing that's going on here, and the reason we're seeing such amazing performance in Final Cut 10 under the hood, is that Final Cut 10 is completely built on what is called the AV Foundation.
Yeah.
And AV Foundation is the replacement. It is the successor to the QuickTime Foundation. And QuickTime has been with us since 1990, forever. And It works okay, but it is very old code. So the reason you're seeing that, like, some video formats will not work in the Macintosh, what's called Quick Look. You know how you select a file and you just hit the space bar? Yeah, yeah.
Where it just says it renders it out, doesn't it, from AV Foundation?
No, Quick Look won't even render it. It'll just go, yeah, here's an icon, it's a video file, and it's really big. And
isn't it trying to open it up in the new QuickTime Player when it actually kind of creates its own,
That's exactly right. So if you try to open, say, an animation codec film video in the QuickTime 7 Player, you'll notice it's rendering it out to, so it's sort of converting it so that it is.
Yeah, you want to play, and then you close it. It says, "Do you want to save this?" Or what?
Yeah, no, exactly.
Not really.
So, yeah, so it has just transcoded it to something else. I'm going to guess probably ProRes 4x4. If it's an animation codec, why would you do that if you don't have an alpha channel in it? It's a whole other show, maybe. But yeah, it's immediately transcoding that. So that's why we're seeing this amazing performance bump. And I think that, you know, I don't know anything about Adobe. Again, I'm just speculating here. But I would say that, you know, until you make your own software and your own hardware, it's very dangerous for them to, you know, sort of depend on the AV Foundation's giant air quotes here standard to be the same, because people don't know what Apple's doing, and that is a problem. Their silence, that, you know, Willy Wonka factory with Oompa Loompas in it, does not serve this community well. But it has also brought us this amazing workhorse. That plays back these giant files in real time and even does keying and stuff. So it's spectacular. Stuart, if we've talked about a lot of things, and I know what, based on the conversation we have had, I know what I would ask for to answer this question, your last question here. If you could sneak in and talk to the engineers at Apple, the programmers, and get them to make the Stuart Moore feature, what would it be? And we'll even call it that in the menu. It'll be, you just pull down, it'll say Stuart Moore.
Well, it's not very original at all. It's just really in the color board, just to not have to go backwards and forwards to,
to add another color corrector.
Yeah, just so you can have it side by side. You know, maybe more scopes, but really just that kind of, you know, the first correction and then going backwards, and just so it's more open, more on screen all the time.
Yeah,
if you want it to be.
Well, there's that, but there's also this problem. When you are in the color board, if you want to add another color corrector, you have to exit out of the color board, add it, and then when you go back in, you have access to it in the little pull-down menu. Why can't I just add another one there? Why can't I turn on and off my masks there? You know, there's a lot of gray space in that menu. We could easily add a few, you know, add me another color corrector.
I mean, it's just something when you're going down what used to be a timeline, down your project, and having to keep going backwards and forwards, it's not bad, but it just seems an obvious kind of improvement. But I'm an old programmer, but it doesn't sound something which would be, you know, it's just an interface thing, feels like, to me, rather than any real, maybe enormously complicated.
Yeah, it's funny.
To the programmers. But conceptually, it's just what I guess most people would want, you know, unless you're doing, a couple of shots of color correcting, which I guess, is pretty rare, isn't it? Like, unless you're just fixing a couple of, dud shots, you're going to go through the whole project,
right,
color correcting. And it's just one thing that just feels like quite clunky.
Well, hold on a second. Are you aware, Stuart, that let's say the ideal scenario is you have a simple, timeline that is basically just, some A roll and some B roll up above, that as you play through the timeline, The little ball, the little bouncy
ball.
Yeah,
the one that goes over the live or the, it,
right,
the focus clip.
Well, it goes, yeah, it's highlighting the focus clip. It's going to default to the topmost clip. But if you play to a shot and you go, oh, I want to affect this and stop it, as long as the ball is on that clip, you don't have to check anything. You don't have to click on anything in the timeline. You don't have to. You can leave the color board open and just go to the next shot, diddle, because those color board controls are now for the new clip that is highlighted with the bouncing ball.
Yeah, I mean, that was the problem, wasn't it? You know, I used to find in Final Cut 7 is that if you weren't careful, the clip you were adjusting was actually the one
that you're not
clip.
Looking
yeah,
at.
Yeah, 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 yeah. If you hadn't double-clicked it to kind of bring that one into whatever it used to be.
The viewer.
The viewer, wasn't it? Yeah. It used to be.
So then I'm gonna jump in on your bandwagon here, and I'm fairly certain we can't do this, but I would love to, as you can with many compositing apps, including Motion, give me Command R or something. Give me rulers, and then from those rulers, allow me to drag out guides.
Oh God, that would be so good! Yeah, that's a real thing, isn't it? If you're titling in Final Cut 10.
Yeah, just... and you know, yes, stuff snaps to each other, but why can't I just have guides?
Yeah,
you know, like, you know, they don't have to stay on when you're playing. You can let them go.
It's so good in Keynote, isn't it? I think you've mentioned that. It's just so easy and good.
Although I wish you could copy guides from one slide to another, or if you made guides in the master slide, they appeared in every child of it.
Mm.
But that's another show. I'm going to call the Keynote Snack Shop or something. Anyway, Stuart, thanks for your time. I really appreciate you doing this, and good luck to you on everything.
Thanks very much. Bye.
All right. As I said in the interview, if it isn't geeky enough, we're going to turn up the geek level. So, I don't know if you would go so far as to say, you know, a small fraternity of people that do this kind of stuff, but it is a bit unusual, and I want to thank you for indulging Stuart and I in having that conversation. I tell you what it really all boils down to is that Final Cut 10 is built on the AV Foundation as opposed to the QuickTime framework. And, you know, Philip Hodgetts was the first one that I heard talking about this, you know, maybe 5 years ago on his blog. And I got to say, Philip, you were way ahead of the curve realizing how important that was going to be. And it's what gives us the amazing playback performance that we have in Final Cut 10. So anyway, thanks for listening. That's it for this Monday episode. If you would be so kind, go check out on iTunes. You probably found the show on iTunes, although I typically tweet right or send out links right to the website. But go to iTunes, leave a comment, leave some stars. From what I understand, only the 5-star works. No, I'm totally joking. You can star it whatever you want, but I prefer 5, and it just helps other people find the show when the grill pops up in the, you know, most recent, most current, most popular shows, which it does occasionally. Anyway, that's it. We'll be back next time with another exciting episode. Good grief, I sound like a bad TV show of Final Cut Grill. Later.